This is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86473, Gwaltney of Smithfield versus Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Inc. Mr. Prettyman, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here on certiorari to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it involves the question of whether citizens can sue for purely past violations as opposed to ongoing violations under the Clean Water Act. Congress has set up a rather interesting dual system of regulating effluent discharges into the nation's waterways. The states adopt these plans, which are approved by the administrator of EPA. The states issue permits, which set forth the effluent limitations and standards under which the permit holders can discharge, and then to demonstrate that he is operating within the ambits of his permit, the discharger is required to constantly test the effluents and to fill out DMRs, or discharge monitoring reports, which are on public file and which anyone can go see. These DMRs show on their face when the permit holder is operating within the parameters of the permit, and they also show on their face if, in fact, the discharger is exceeding those limits. Thus, citizens groups like respondents can review these DMRs on the public record and then give 60-day notice if they're going to sue for alleged violations. And if the suits are not settled, then they can collect $10,000 a day, which has now been up to $25,000 a day, except when I say collect, I really mean that that money, of course, goes to the United States and not to them. They allege in their allegations the permit holder to be in violation. They usually attach these DMRs to their complaints, and as I say, in theory at least, the recovery goes to the United States. When Gwaltney of Smithfield purchased a meat rendering and packing plant from ITT toward the end of 1981, it found after the purchase that it had inherited some problems, principally with the biological treatment system.
Which it had no prior knowledge?
They did have knowledge that ITT had had problems. They thought the problems had been solved. They found after they purchased that the problems had not been solved. These problems involve primarily chlorine, fecal coliform, and total kildall nitrogen, or TKN. And it thereafter experiences various exceedances in various parameters of its permit. However, it then installed two new systems, and it's undisputed that all of the exceedances had, in fact, stopped prior to this suit. The Court of Appeals so held. It was so stipulated between the parties, and the respondents even concede in their question presented before this Court that this case involves only past violations. First, as to chlorine, I'll touch on these just briefly. As to chlorine, we found many problems in installing a new automatic chlorinator, but that finally fell into place in October of 82, so that there were no exceedances for some 20 months, or almost 2 years, prior to the trial in this matter. With the exception of startup exceedances, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, The same is really true for fecal coliform. That is that they substantially ended in 1982. We had more problem with the TKN and had to install largely a new system. And there were various fits and starts, including a 6 months delay by the State Water Control Board itself. But the system was finally approved by the state, and it began operation in October of 83, and it was fully online in December. So that the only TKN exceedances between then and one...
Why, there's something?
Yes, Your Honor, is the alternative to violation, because if you use violation, there seems to be some import
was
that...
Was it coined
fact,
for this industry or something?
Pardon me?
Was it coined for this statute?
No, it is my understanding it's regularly used in the industry. It's not just for this case. What it means is, Your Honor, is that you have exceeded the limits in your permit, but an exceedance, of course, could be a permissible upset or it could be for other permissible reason. Therefore, it's not necessarily a violation. And as I was saying, the exceedances here, as far as TKN is concerned, were the unavoidable startup exceedances before suit. The district court held that there is no way to start up a biological treatment system without violations. But the important point here, really, to focus on is that the last fecal coliform exceedance was 4 months before suit. TKN was a full month before suit, and, of course, the chlorine was 20 months ago. So the case comes to you with the rather pristine question of whether citizens can sue for purely past violations, those which have abated prior to suit. The Court of Appeals held that they can. We say that they can't. The Solicitor General interprets the Act as we do as to past violations. We disagree with him only in respect of how he interprets the word alleged in the statute, and therefore with his recommended disposition of the case.
Mr. Prettyman, did the district court have an alternative holding below that there were continuing violations?
What it had, Justice O'Connor,
was under the impression that it did, and that holding was just not reviewed by the Court of Appeals.
That alternative holding, which was in a footnote, was that even if you couldn't sue for past violations, that there was a good faith allegation of ongoing violations. I would emphasize in regard to that, first of all, as you point out, the Court of Appeals.
Even if you were right, at best, what would happen? It would be vacated and remanded so that could be considered?
If you reach that question, because you don't have to reach it, of course, if you reach that question, I would certainly think you would want to remand to the Court of Appeals for its consideration. But you shouldn't have to reach that question at all because in view of the fact that it is quite clear, both from the facts, the holding, and the stipulation, that everything had stopped, had abated prior to the suit, it really didn't make any difference whether the allegations were good faith or not.
Well, unless the trier of fact thought that there was indeed a likelihood of some continuing problem, for example, with the TKN-type discharge.
In that regard, Justice O'Connor, I wonder if I could call your attention to footnotes, I think they're 25 and 26 of the district court's opinion. Because he very well addressed those particular matters, 25 and 26, where he in effect said that some question has arisen as to whether these problems would continue, but I regard that as entirely too speculative to find. He in effect holds in these two footnotes that the problem has entirely ceased. And I want to point out to you that the respondents are not here arguing anything about good faith allegations or that these were ongoing violations. What they're here arguing is that they can sue for past violations, period. They pose the suit because they know what
the... Can the EPA administrator bring a civil penalty action for purely past violations?
That is an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't know the answer to that yet. The government says yes, but it's interesting that...
The language is the same.
No, with great respect, Your Honor, it is not the same. The language in regard to the government is in Section 309 or 1319, and the language is quite different. It is so different that the government, when it seeks to bring a suit for past penalties, doesn't even rely on this statute. It relies on the judicial code.
The government relies on statutes outside because
Correct.
Of the similarity.
And they do that because the language is really not clear in this statute itself as whether it's a very convoluted statute when it comes to the government's rights. But certainly, even if the point I want to make is that even if the government can sue for past violations, it is quite clear that the language and the rights are very different from those that relate to a citizen, and the Solicitor General is very strong on that point, that he does not believe for a moment that a citizen has the same rights as and comes under the same language as the government does.
Mr. Prettyman, the language governing private civil actions doesn't say has violated, but it doesn't say is violating either. It says, is in violation of.
Yes.
Now, that, it seems to me, means something quite different from is now violating. If you're caught by radar exceeding the speed limit and a police car pulls alongside you after you've realized that you've been caught and you've lowered your speed, he doesn't say into your window, you are violating the speed limit. You were violating it 5 miles back. He will say, you know, you were in violation of the speed limit.
That would be very fair, Your Honor, if that's all the further we went. But the fact is that this statute, two things go to that. First of all, this statute uses the present tense in at least four other places in this same 1365.
But the present tense speaking of a status, the status of being in violation. Now, what if I think that status means you've violated it in the past and you haven't done anything that seems likely to eliminate that possibility of violation in the future?
Well,
what if I consider that to be what in violation of means?
You may then be engaged in an ongoing violation. And, in fact, under our definition, you may be able to sue because an ongoing violation is a present noncompliance because of a failure to correct an underlying difficulty. And if you have, in fact, violated for several times, you have done nothing about it, and the suit is brought, that may be an ongoing violation, may be perfectly proper to sue. That's not what happened here. In this suit, what happened was there were a series of exceedances, and we did something about it. We put in place two new systems which were supposed to deal with it. After the systems were in place, we had unavoidable startup exceedances which could not be avoided. The district court so held. They were no more normal, the district court again held, than you would expect in an ordinary case. And it was right at the tail end of this, knowing that the situation had abated, knowing that it had been corrected and had come to a close, that respondents come in and sue.
Is that knowledge clear? You said that the last violation, the TKN violation, was exceedance, if you want to put it that way, was 1 month before suit was filed. But at the time suit was filed, was it clear that the new equipment you had put in would do the job?
I don't think there's any question about that, Your Honor, as the district court ultimately held in the footnotes that I pointed out to you and where he said we were, in fact, in compliance. And also...
I didn't ask whether you were. I asked, was it clear at the time of that the suit was filed that the new equipment was effective to do the job?
I think so. And this is the reason I say so, Your Honor. First of all, they knew that the new equipment had been put in. Secondly, they knew that it had been completed. They attended a meeting in March of the State Water Control Board at which this was discussed. And the State Water Control Board said, look, it looks to us like you're getting this thing under control. There's no need for any further action. Then there were some unavoidable startup exceedances. I keep emphasizing that because you cannot start a new plant, much less fix an old plant, without having some of these unavoidable startup exceedances.
But the fact it's unavoidable doesn't get you off the hook, does it? I mean, the statute doesn't require negligence or willfulness to make it an exceedance.
Well, let me say two things to that, Your Honor. First of all, even the unavoidable startup exceedances had ceased prior to suit. But secondly, even if they had been going on, it may well be that a startup exceedance could be a past violation that, for example, the state could go after. But by definition, it cannot be an ongoing violation. An ongoing violation is something where something is going on because of a problem and you are not fixing it. You're not doing anything about it. This is a situation where we've done everything about it. We put in a new system. We spent $265,000 putting it in. It is now, the crust is starting to form on the lagoons, which takes a long time. That's the problem, getting that into shape. And those exceedances cannot possibly constitute an ongoing violation by their very nature. They are the tail end of abatement. The whole purpose of this statute is abatement. The statute, you've got to remember, follows directly upon the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act, as you will recall, had only an injunctive provision in it, and it related only to compliance, only to ongoing, only to abatement. The one thing that this statute added to the Clean Air Act was the remedy of penalties. And that, by adding the penalties, what it seems to me Congress clearly did was to say, we're going to add an extra incentive for you to stop sooner, because by saying that you're going to get penalties and not just an injunction, it comes very much to your advantage to stop at the earliest possible moment during the 60-day period, for example. You get your 60-day notice. If you can abate in there and stop, you have avoided your penalties, and that's what the Act is entirely about.
Well, Mr. Prettyman, what's the test for violation and to get into court in this citizen suit? You don't really take the position, as I read your brief, that there has to be a violation on the day the suit is filed.
Correct. I'm not sure I can define it any better than I did a little while ago, and that is present noncompliance for failure to correct a situation. Our definition would be that if there, and the Fifth Circuit pointed this out in the Sierra Club versus Shell Oil, that you can't just take an exceedance here, an exceedance there, and kind of bunch them all together and say, this is an ongoing violation. What you do is you kind of look behind them and you see, is there a reason for this? Is it ongoing? Do you have here somebody who has just turned off the spigot in order to avoid a suit? Is it a periodic, episodic violator who is just trying to avoid suit? In other words, the district court can look at the facts very much as he does in a regular injunction proceeding to determine whether there is a problem which is creating exceedances which you have not corrected, you have not done anything about. If you have not, then it is an ongoing violation.
And if there's any question about the efficacy of the so-called correction, is that something that would entitle the citizen to sue and litigate about?
Might well. Now, for example, let's suppose you have taken some action, but it's the improper action, it's ineffective action, it's not enough action, it won't work. That's something that the court would be entitled to look to see whether, in fact, there is an ongoing problem that you have not properly addressed.
So possibly the plaintiffs below had at least that much of a complaint with regard to the TKN problem.
With great respect, Justice O'Connor, that just isn't possible in this case, because they knew that we had installed a system. They knew that the system had been approved by the state. They knew that thereafter the state met and said, we think we've got this under control. They knew,
Mr. Prettyman, didn't the district court find, and I think this is the word he used, that the chapter correct, was lackadaisical, an exceedingly unconcerned attitude toward correcting anything?
That
in the 31 months prior to the suit, the plant was in compliance with permit conditions only 4 months?
That, Your Honor, related to the prior period when we were still wrestling with getting this whole thing into place, and we may well have been in violation, in an ongoing violation at that time. It may be that we could have sued at that time. But he's not referring to the later period where, if you'll see, I think it's Joint Appendix 115 in that area where he says that at the end, which is the period we're talking about, just before they brought suit, these were unavoidable and were anticipated. As a matter of fact, in all the plans that the state had looked at prior to that, they had always put in a period for exceedances after the system went into effect, because they knew that even after you put the system into effect, you're going to have a period of exceedances that you can't avoid.
Prettyman,
yes, sir.
If they'd put it in 12 months ahead of time, they wouldn't have had that problem, would they?
If they had put the new system in before they did, it would have stopped sooner.
Yes.
There's no question about that, Your Honor, and I'm not...
And there wouldn't have been no possibility of filing the suit.
That's...
But they didn't.
Well, I wouldn't say there's no possibility of filing suit, depending upon how quickly they did it and what manner, but... This suit is not about, and even respondents do not say it is about, whether the penalties were correct, assuming that penalties should be issued because we didn't move quickly enough. What the suit is about is whether you can get penalties at all for purely past violations
Suppose there is an ongoing violation under your own definition at the time suit is filed, but within 2 or 3 months, the whole matter is cleared up. Now, you would say the suit was proper at the outset, but should it then be dismissed when there is compliance?
If there was jurisdiction at the time that the suit was brought, because there was an ongoing violation at that time, the district court got jurisdiction.
Got jurisdiction, and the citizen suit was proper at that time.
Correct.
What happens then when there's compliance?
Well, first of all, I assume if he was satisfied with the compliance, he would not issue an injunction, but he may well issue penalties.
For what?
For the period up until the time that they stopped.
Why should he be able to issue penalties for violations prior to the filing of the suit?
Because, Your Honor, at the time the suit was filed, there was jurisdiction. And the reason that there was jurisdiction was that this statute requires an ongoing violation at the time suit was filed. And in your hypothetical, there was an ongoing violation.
So you essentially agree with the government in that regard?
Absolutely.
Yes.
The government and we are very close on our interpretation of that. And perhaps I ought to turn then to the one difference between us and the government before I come back to other matters.
I take it your answer to one of Justice White's questions, however, is it that under those circumstances the district court should dismiss the complaint? Jurisdiction attached, and then there was compliance. What happens to the lawsuit?
Well, what I would say under those circumstances is that he should not issue an injunction if he's satisfied that that there is true compliance and abatement, but that he may well decide to issue penalties because he had jurisdiction at the time that the suit was brought. Now, I want to say just one thing before I get to the word to this business of allegations. I just want to point out to you that really this statute makes no sense if you're going to treat it as going to pass violation. Let me just give you two brief examples. The citizen would be giving notice of something that's already abated. All the courts that have looked at this agree that one of the purposes of giving 60-day notice to the permit holder is to allow him to get himself into shape and to abate and get rid of the problem. Here you have a situation where somebody's suing for penalties 5 years old, maybe 15 years old, because we don't know what the statute of limitations is. There is none in the statute. So you're suing for 15 years old, and you're giving the man 60 days' notice for what? It doesn't make any sense. The only thing that makes sense is that you're giving him 60 days' notice of an ongoing violation. One other example. The citizen couldn't sue for past violations when the administrator is already suing for ongoing violations. I realize this is a little difficult, but if you will look at the language in 1365, you will see that what it says is that when the administrator is actively prosecuting a suit for compliance, the citizen can't come in and sue. Now, the only way that makes any sense at all is if they're both trying to sue for the same thing. That is, the citizen is trying to sue for an ongoing violation, and the government suing for an ongoing violation. If you have the citizen stopped from suing for past violations because the government is suing for present, or the government is not suing for present and they're both suing at the time, same time for past, it doesn't make any sense. The statute doesn't hang together. It makes no sense. But let me move then to the one point of difference between us and the Solicitor General, and that's this business of the allegation. He puts a great deal of stress on the word allege, and he feels that a good faith allegation of ongoing violation gets the citizens past the jurisdictional requirement of an ongoing violation. Now, I want to emphasize, as we've already pointed out, that the Court of Appeals never passed on this, and that even the district court said that the good faith allegation related only to TKN. And Justice O'Connor, TKN was the smaller part, as you know, of the award. $1 million was for chlorination, which stopped 20 months before. But even as to TKN, that's very confusing because the government concedes that once you make an allegation, and we contest it under 12b-1, the court can go behind it. And all we're saying is here, you can allege all you want to that something is ongoing, but if, in fact, we challenge you, you have the burden of proving that it's true. This is true in any kind of a suit. It's true in a suit where I file a suit against you on diversity grounds in Pennsylvania, and I attach all of your prior reports to show you're there, and you file a motion to dismiss, and you say, I'm sorry, I've moved into your state, Maryland, since my last report.
Isn't the government's position that it's to be applied something like Rule 11, a good faith belief?
Yes, but look what that does, Your Honor. Someone who files a group of DMRs, just as someone who files your last 10 quarterly reports, would in good faith believe that we are in the midst of an ongoing violation or that you are located in Pennsylvania. But if that is attacked, and in fact you have moved from Pennsylvania and into Maryland, and if in fact our violations have come to a halt prior to suit, they have been abated, they have been cleaned up and stopped, which is the purpose of the Act, then all we're saying is that you can't go ahead with a suit where a mere allegation gets you to trial. If the allegation is wrong, it doesn't make any difference what your good faith is. It is wrong. I see I don't have much time left, and if I could, I'd like to save just a few moments for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well, Mr. Prettyman. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Claiborne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. It may be useful to begin by indicating the degree to which both the District Court and the Court of Appeal did deal with the question whether there was a risk of repetition of the violations which it had noticed for the past. And I simply want to draw the Court's attention to two footnotes, both reproduced in the appendix to the petition. The first one is from the District Court opinion and appears on page 38A. It's footnote 8, and there one finds the district court's holding, alternative holding, that at the time the complaint was filed, there was sufficient ground to believe in good faith that the problem had not been cured. What is more, the court itself indicates
that... Is that in footnote 8 on page 38A?
Yes, Your Honor. The problem of determining whether a violation is continuing is highlighted well in this case. Skipping a bit, with the history of violations of its TKN violations in the wintertime, Galtree had just experienced another winter of repeated violations, despite the change it had implemented in its wastewater treatment system. At the time of trial in December 1984, now that's 6 months after the complaint was filed, one of Galtree's own witnesses expressed doubt as to whether Galtree would meet its TKN violations limitations. It was not until Galtree had experienced a full winter, the following winter after the trial, without problems, that it could make its motion to dismiss based on its present compliance with a secure belief that it was indeed in compliance. Now, the Court of Appeal, and here I refer the Court to page 7A of the appendix and footnote 9, looking at the second paragraph of that footnote and the second sentence of that paragraph, the Court of Appeal says, a very sound argument can be made that plaintiff's allegations of continuing violations were made in good faith, despite the fact that Galtree has not actually violated the Act since May 15, 1984.
Well, Mr. Claiborne, what about footnotes 25 and 26 that Mr. Prettyman referred to in the district court opinion, which basically say the district court believed that to conclude there were continuing violations would be too speculative on the present record?
I think those, Justice O'Connor, those two statements can be reconciled. What the court is saying is that at the time of filing and at the time of trial, there was ground to fear that there would be repetition of the exceedances, so-called, that is to say, violations, in wintertime. By the time this opinion is written in June of 1985, the court, having experienced a winter without violations, is now saying we don't have ground to fear for the future any longer. There are different times we're talking about.
You don't think the district court opinion reflects the situation as of the conclusion of the trial?
I do, Your Honor.
And that these footnotes indicate that the court found it too speculative to find an ongoing violation at that time?
That is exactly, Justice O'Connor, I may have misspoken. What I meant to indicate was that the court found that in June of 1984, when the complaint was filed, and in December of 1984, when the trial was held, there was still ground to fear that the system, the new system, would not handle the problem during the winter. When this opinion is written, and that is what the ultimate footnotes are addressing, now, judgment being entered, it would be speculative to suppose that there will, the winter having gone by without incident, it would be speculative to suppose that there would be problems for the future.
The trial was over. How does the court know what's happened between the time the record is closed and he writes the opinion?
Your Honor, I frankly don't know whether the court was made aware of the absence of violations December and June.
I would suppose that he was reflecting in these footnotes what was true at the determination of the trial.
Well, I'm attempting to tax the district judge with
that would
consistency.
Be the normal. Wouldn't that be the normal assumption?
Well,
he'd
Your Honor,
writing his opinion based on the record that was made.
The footnote to which I have referred, footnote 8, very clearly indicates that not only in the court's view, but in the view of the expert for the defendant, there was ground to fear that the problem had not been solved as of the date of trial in December 1984.
Why shouldn't the rule be for this jurisdictional argument or this, or whether the citizen can bring a suit as to, at the time of filing the suit, which is, in a lot of courts, will be an awful long time before there's a trial?
Your Honor, this is only a preamble to say, as Your Honor has indicated, there is perhaps little logic in focusing on the state of mind of the plaintiff and the grounds for objective belief at the time of filing as opposed to the time of judgment. And yet, my learned friend seemed to indicate that he would condone the assessment of penalties entirely for the past, provided that at the time of filing there were an ongoing violation, even though it had been demonstrated that the problem was cured before judgment was entered. Now, that to us highlights the reason why it is not sensible to focus on the notion of ongoing violation at all, whether at the time of the suit is filed or at the time when judgment is entered. And it is for that reason that we cannot embrace either the First Circuit's decision or the government's brief here, albeit they might resolve this case favorably to us. Because it seems to us that the logic must be that if it matters whether there's an ongoing violation, the time when that matters is when penalties are being assessed, not when the suit is filed.
So you want us to take the case as it comes to us and decide whether the Court of Appeals was right or wrong?
Indeed.
On its theory?
On its theory.
Mm-hmm. Well, on your construction of the statute, what do you make of the purpose of the 60-day notice provision, which your opponent says doesn't make sense unless it's to give an opportunity to abate?
I'm grateful to the Chief Justice for having focused my attention on that question. The legislative history as to the reason why that 60-day provision was inserted never mentions one reason being to afford the violator an opportunity to get off the hook. That is nowhere suggested in the legislative history as a reason for the notice. The reason for the notice is to allow the government, indeed both governments, federal and state governments, to take this opportunity to decide whether they wish to enforce the act and thereby preempt a citizen suit. And that is...
The notice doesn't just go to the government. It's noted both to the government and to the violator. What's the reason for the notice to the violator?
I suppose, Justice Scalia, there are two reasons for the notice going to the violator. The first is that when a violator or an alleged violator is being reported to the authorities as such, as violating the Act, it seems only fair to give him notice of that. Not so that he can get off the hook for the past violation, but perhaps so that he will more quickly come into compliance and afford himself an opportunity to be liable for fewer penalties for a shorter time. It does have that effect of goading the violator into ceasing more quickly, not in order to be totally absolved for the past, but to shorten the period for which he will owe penalties. If indeed penalties are appropriate, and we do not maintain that penalties are always appropriate, no matter how isolated the violation, no matter how old it may be, no matter how quickly it was corrected. Those are matters which the district court, in its discretion, may determine at the penalty phase. They have no bearing on the jurisdiction of the court to entertain the case.
Well,
they have every bearing on the penalty.
I'm troubled by, suppose we have a situation of two or three isolated violations 5 years before the suit is filed, and the citizen files the suit seeking only civil penalties for those prior violations. Now, you want us to hold that that kind of a suit is perfectly permitted and that the court has jurisdiction, right?
I would say, Justice O'Connor, and there may be a question about whether 5 years is beyond...
Well, there's no statute of limitations.
Well, that's not entirely clear. There is a suggestion that the statute...
Let's not go off on that. Let's assume there is none.
It so happens the statute of limitations, it would be applicable as a 5-year one, which is the other reason I mentioned it. But let's say it's 4 years ago, and otherwise matters are as Your Honor suggested. That is a case in which we would say there is jurisdiction in the district court to entertain the citizen complaint.
Well, now, the penalties go only to the government. Is that right?
That is so.
And how does the citizen have standing in a constitutional sense to come in and get those?
Well, let me say first that the question of standing had not been taken to this court.
I know, but doesn't that inform our interpretation of the statute?
Well, it may be that because standing in the strict sense is jurisdictional, it's before this court in any event, and I'm not trying to avoid the question. I'm just giving a prefatory explanation. In our view, standing in the citizen complainant, and he must be, under the statute, not any citizen, but one who is aggrieved by the pollution which occurs. Now, that means, and as is true in this case, that a member or more members of the organization must live on or near the affected water and be injured by its pollution, either in his commercial or recreational activities there. That shows that he has injury in fact. Now, it is perfectly true that the assessment of penalties will not immediately and directly redress that injury. But it will have a substantially beneficial effect on his interest in that river in the following three ways. First, the threat of the imposition of such penalties is likely, as the EPA policy on penalties is at pains to indicate, to deter him from violating in the first place. But even after he has violated, if he has been assessed substantial penalties, it is an assurance that he will not return to his old ways. Even in circumstances where an injunction would not have been necessary, the assessment of penalties against him does obviously deter him from doing it again.
Well, it
but thirdly,
seems to
and
me
perhaps
that
most
really people, is stretching any traditional notice of standing.
Your Honor, I think not. It has a very particular effect on the particular river and the particular injury that this individual plaintiff is concerned about. And the third way in which it relieves his concern is that it deters not merely that same violator, but others on the same river or river system who would otherwise feel free to pollute the river until enjoined.
On that analysis, you would say that Congress would have the power to confer standing upon any citizen to prosecute violations of crimes within his community. Congress could pass a law saying the United States attorney shall no longer be the sole person who can prosecute crimes, but any person in the community in which the crime occurred may bring a prosecution.
Justice Scalia, there are, I assume, independent reasons not related to standing why an individual ought not be permitted to prosecute criminally. So far as the answer on standing, I suppose the answer must be yes, that prosecuting for crimes and prosecuting for penalties would serve the interest and protect the values in that river to the same degree. But I
thought your answer to Justice O'Connor's question was that you had to be affected by the particular pollution in question before you could sue as a citizen. And therefore, it seems to me your answer to Justice Scalia ought to be the logical counterpart would be to allow victims to bring a prosecution for crime, but not just anyone in the community.
Well, I suppose that Justice Scalia was really asking me, and I shouldn't be making such assumptions, whether this same citizen who lives on or near the river would have equal standing to bring a criminal prosecution as he does in my submission, to bring an action for civil penalties. And if put that way, my answer is yes, he's got equal standing, but the privilege of prosecution is one that for other constitutional reasons, not standing, are not available to the ordinary citizen. And this court...
You never got to your third reason, did you? Or the third way that a citizen, person is affected?
Justice White, the third way is in deterring others on the same river who would otherwise feel sanguine about polluting the river. And I must say that we are talking here about the imposition of civil penalties, not a marginal, peripheral, unimportant sanction. It is, as the EPA policy has made clear, probably the most important sanction in government enforcement. One would suppose that when the citizen is given the privilege of standing in for the government, provided he has standing of personal interest in the matter, he ought to have, as much as possible, the same weapons. Now, he cannot issue administrative orders. He cannot institute criminal prosecutions. But when it comes to civil actions, one would expect him to be able to obtain like relief. And this relief, the imposition of penalties, is the most important instrument because otherwise a polluter has every incentive to delay compliance and to profit by his advantage over complying competitors and to delay the expenditures.
Are attorney's fees available in these suits?
They're available in both directions, Your Honor, and Congress was well aware that there might be a tendency to abuse the citizen supervision. So it provided, and the legislative history notes it, that attorney's fees are available to the plaintiff, but they're available against him if he files frivolous, vexatious, or harassing litigation. And that, of course, is a deterrent to the frivolous plaintiff who...
Claiborne, what is the status of a civil plaintiff who is a property owner along the river who says his property was damaged by the pollution? Does he have any remedy?
Under this court's holding that there is no action for damages in federal law, he would not be able to invoke either the Clean Water Act or the federal common law in order to make himself whole, but he would be free to invoke state damage remedies nuisance law to obtain damages.
Isn't it sort of anomalous that there's no federal remedy for the direct injury, but there's standing to sue on behalf of the government for penalties?
Well, it
not
isn't.
Really on behalf of, but.
It would be extraordinary if the solution to the standing problem were to have a key time action which this court has more than once indicated presents no constitutional problem, which Congress only last year reaffirmed and widened with respect to the False Claims Act. Thereby, if we had a quitam action in which the informer had a pecuniary interest because he got a share of the assessment, and yet you would widen the class of potential plaintiffs to include any citizen, as is true under the False Claims Act. Now, that simply cannot be the way one solves a constitutional standing problem, and yet it would seem to be, if this court were to hold that there is such a problem, a simple remedy for Congress at the next session. Now, I want to, making a very disconnected argument, but I want to stress that Congress did not use language in this statute with all the precision that one might have hoped for. There is loose language. There is misuse of language. That is easily demonstrated by anyone who reads the Act. It seems to us that the court ought to prefer to tax Congress with loose language, a lapse of tense, perhaps, not clearly, but perhaps, even somewhat illiterate sentences here and there, rather than to attribute to Congress a scheme which is downright nonsense. It is downright nonsense to say there shall be penalties assessable in citizen suits. And as to that, there can be no question. The statute says so in so many words. And then to say, but that means only in those rare cases, because they must be rare, in which, despite having been notified 60 days before, the polluter is so perverse and so improvident as to continue his evil ways until the day of filing or perhaps the day of judgment. Maybe that's the government's position, I'm not sure. Because otherwise, he is excused from all penalties and the court has no power to impose them. One thing or the other, it is conceivable to hesitate to give the power to assess penalties going to the Treasury to a private plaintiff. One can understand that. But once you do give a plaintiff that power, you don't take it all back from him and make it available only in that rare case that it will almost never occur. That is the case where the polluter is so perverse and so improvident as to continue his violation long enough to give the court jurisdiction to enter these awards. That simply cannot have been the intent of Congress. It was mentioned that Section 505.1b, this is reproduced in petitioner's brief at page 3, refers to an action to require compliance. And that is an action to require compliance by a citizen, which would be barred if the government has previously filed. And the suggestion is that an action for penalties is not an action to require compliance. Therefore, Congress is telling us here that it never intended to authorize an action for penalties. And we know it did, so we're a bit at a loss. But the other thing to be noticed about this provision is that it doesn't use language quite so fastidiously. The words are that the federal or state governments, that the citizen suit will not lie if the federal or state governments has commenced and is diligently prosecuting a civil or criminal action in a court of the United States to require compliance with the standard limitation and so forth. Well, obviously, a criminal action is not, strictly speaking, an action to require compliance any more than an action to collect penalties. What is proved here is simply that Congress was not punctilious in its use of language, not that it meant that there was no action by the citizen to secure an assessment of penalties. Indeed, the Congress in 1985, 86, and 87 made quite clear that it understood itself some years earlier to have authorized citizen suits in respect of wholly past violations and to the assessment of penalties without an injunction in those circumstances. I draw the
section may bring to realization the question that I asked you, because it permits the citizen to intervene as a matter of right in the criminal action, apparently.
Justice Scalia, I wonder whether they really meant it. I think that's rather a lapse. We do not claim that right. Section 309D was added in 1987. It had been prepared in 1985 and 1986. The provision, for quite independent reasons, was vetoed by the President, and so was not enacted in its final form until 1987. Its purpose, so far as we're concerned, was to add to the Clean Water Act an ability for the administrator to assess penalties administratively. He had already issued cease and desist orders administratively, but he could not assess penalties in this way. Having given the administrator that authority, and we are clear on both sides that this authority relates solely to past events, solely to past violations which attract these civil penalties. Congress went on to say that a citizen suit would lie in respect of the same violations only if notified or filed before the administrator acted. Now, according to the petitioner, that was unnecessary to say because there could be no citizen suit notified or filed in respect of purely past violations. Here is Congress indicating that it understood otherwise. I may say that the petitioner himself obviously understood otherwise during the 11 months before the filing of a motion to dismiss on this ground, and when it took the trouble to seek amendment of the summary judgment that had been entered in August 1984 to absolve itself in respect of the violations that had occurred before it acquired the property. What was the point of that, except that it feared that penalties would be assessed in respect of those old violations? It was only 11 months later that, and only when the Fifth Circuit handed down its Hamker decision, that anybody for the first time focused on the present tense in 505 and said, ah, this qualifies the entire statute. We had it wrong. No penalties can be assessed in a citizen suit except only when, for reasons not easy to understand, they're in effect combined with an injunction. One time you don't need penalties because the injunction serves the purpose and its violation will, of course, attract civil and criminal contempt penalties of its own. For these reasons, we urge affirmance of the judgment of the Court of Appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Claiborne. Mr. Prettyman, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Just a few very quick points, Your Honor. I would urge that you read the end of footnote 9, which my good friend for the respondents did not get to. He called your attention to the first part of it. We file a motion to dismiss almost a year after the last violation, which clearly alerted the district court judge that there had been no violations during the course of that year. When he ruled, he was fully familiar with that. I have to go outside of the record to make the following statement, and that is that there have been none for now 4 years. And I say that with equanimity because I'm sure my respondents won't dispute it. There was one hurricane upset, but other than that. The problem with the Article 3 is that I think it may be directed in your questions, Justice Scalia, to perhaps the wrong point. The real problem with Article 3 is redressability. That is, when all of the penalties go to the government and you don't have an injunction going to the underlying fact, you have an injury that is not redressed by any remedy, and that poses the Article 3. And I would urge the Court to be very careful here if it's going to open the floodgates to these past suits, because you know you're not only going to have these federal suits for going back, we don't know how many years, maybe 15, but we're going to have Pandini state claims. You're going to be trying state claims in federal courts going back 15 years, which is going to be attached to those federal claims, which is going to cause great hazard to the federal courts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Prettyman. The case is submitted.